Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
Do you remember your first funeral? I do. I was in kindergarten. My mom's mom, my grandma Shovlin, died. And I remember getting pulled out of school and mom and dad being real sad and being sent to the barber shop to get my hair cut because there was a time when I actually needed such a thing. I remember one of the aunts having to stay up late to alter one of the cousin's suits so I had something to wear. But what I remember most was the visitation at the old funeral home in Sheraton. It was, of course, in an old house, right? And we were set up for the visitation in kind of the receiving room, but I was only 5 or 6, right? Because I was in kindergarten. I was the youngest grandkid, so I was real squirmy and was not really behaving especially well. So a couple of the older cousins took it upon themselves to entertain me. I don't remember everything that we did, but I can see very, very clearly one of the older cousins chasing me down a hallway, and the mixed looks of sort of delight and disapproval on the parts of the grown-ups who are happy that I'm no longer a pain in the big room, but not altogether happy with playing hide-and-seek in the funeral home. I remember taking a sharp right down this hallway and there being like a short flight of stairs and then a proper flight of stairs, and I thought, this is going to be the best place to get away from the cousin. And I got down to the foot of the stairs and there were 2 double doors, saloon style, right, swinging. And I burst through the doors and stopped short enough that the cousin who was chasing me ran into my back. Because there, on a metal slab in front of me, was an old man who was naked and very, very dead. This was back in the days before we worried about, like, traumatizing children by sending them to funerals. I don't think your kid's ever going to get really traumatized by a funeral, but maybe the morgue you hold off till high school with. It scared me to death. And the thing about this is, which I think is really important, that like the 2 or 3 hours before this, I spent just feet from my dead granny's body. So it's not like I'd never seen a dead person before. I just spent a couple hours with a dead person. I remember my parents bringing me into the room right up to the casket, showing me, she looks like she's sleeping. See, she's holding her rosary just like she did when she was alive. I remember, you know, being made to say an Our Father and a Hail Mary and a Glory Be for the dead person. Now, that's what we do when we go to funerals. This is what we ought to do. But I did not think about praying when I found that dead man on the slab. My first intuition wasn't to pray. It was to run and get out of there because it was horrifying. Grandma looked like she was asleep. That man did not look like he was sleeping. We work so hard to sanitize the dead, to make sure they look like they're alive. And there's a great temptation, this time of year especially, in these last days of Great Lent, as we approach Holy Week itself, to try and sanitize his death. And that would be a big mistake. That's the reason, among others, that the church gives us this reading today, the story of the raising of Lazarus. This is the story of Jesus facing death head on, looking death face to face. And if we don't understand the horror of death, then we won't be able to get why the resurrection is so marvelous. Otherwise, it'll just be some other magic trick. Death, this might be an understatement, death is like real bad. Like really, really bad. Because it hurts so much to grieve, we try and tell ourselves sort of inanities or pious lies to make it hurt less. But the whole reason it hurts is because death is rather permanent, somewhat final, like the worst thing that can happen in a life. That's why all life works to keep itself alive. Death by itself is wicked, is contrary to God's law. And that's the reason Jesus giving life to the dead man and then sharing his own resurrected life with us changes everything. This reading, the passage of Lazarus, has two important places in the history of the church. It always comes just before the start of Holy Week, though the days shifted a little bit. And that's because we need to see how Jesus encounters death before we see how he faces his own. And the other place that in history we would encounter this passage is that up until the reforms after Vatican II, this was the only reading that would get used at Christian funerals. For, I don't know, 15, 16, 1700 years, this is the only passage that would be read at a funeral. And I have to admit, my first few years as a priest, I never did. It's still the first in the book, but I never used it, and this is why. It seems to me cruel to be preaching about the one time Jesus unambiguously brought a man back to life in front of a family who clearly wants nothing more than their loved one to come back to life. But the problem is, I can look at a corpse all day and say, get up, get up, get up. They ain't never getting up. And you know why? I'm not Jesus. I'm privileged in particular moments to speak on his behalf, but I'm not Christ. I don't have the power to bring the dead back to life, but he did. And this, I think, is the reason that the church gives us that passage for funerals, whether we use that or something else. Here, we see Jesus at a funeral for a friend. Now, if our lives as Christians are meant to be friendship with Jesus, to be being Jesus's friend, then we have no better example here than Mary and Martha and Lazarus. They're totally unlike any of the other disciples we see in the Gospels. They appear to be Jesus's friends, maybe even before they became his disciples. They certainly were his friends sort of in priority before being a student. Martha doesn't send word to Jesus and say, Master, the one whom you taught important things about heaven is sick. No, she says, Master, the one whom you love. Mary and Martha knew Jesus' favorite foods and would make it when he came by the house. Lazarus kept his favorite beer in the back of the first century fridge. That's the kind of relationship that they had. And it's because of that, that seeing how Jesus acts in this moment is so important. If you want to be friends with Jesus, then this is how he'll act at your funeral. Weeping with those who love you. Not because he's afraid you can't come back to life, but because he knows how little we understand death and the pain that it'll cause us no matter what. Jesus grows perturbed, annoyed, and he doesn't have any time for the sort of silly things we say at funerals to make ourselves feel better. He doesn't turn to Martha and say, oh, don't worry, dear, at least he's not suffering anymore. He's in a better place. He doesn't turn to Mary and say, it's okay, you've got an angel in heaven now to look over you. He doesn't say anything like that. If anything, what he says is even crazier. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even should he die, that one will live. How cruel, how unkind to say to a grieving woman on her doorstep. Unless, of course, it's true. If it's true, if Jesus isn't playing, if he's not jerking around Mary and Martha with their emotions, if he's not just play-acting in front of the Jewish leaders who've been gathered there, this changes everything. And to show the sign of how it changes everything, Jesus does something here unlike anything he does anyplace else. You can point to the other accounts of restoration to life in the Gospels and say, well, maybe, right? Like the girl with Talitha Kum and give her something to eat. She's dead like 20 minutes, right? That could be a physical healing. The widow at Nain's son died that day because they're carrying him off to be buried. But this guy, well and truly dead. Wicked witch of the West dead. Just as well be under a house dead. He ain't coming back. He's stinking. He's rotting in the grave. And that's important. That's important. Because just as life things being alive shows you what their soul looks like. So death shows you what sin does to your soul. It's like the old anti-drug commercials, remember? This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Okay, so look at your body right now. However healthy or decrepit you find yourself, but like if you can wiggle your finger, this is what your soul looks like. It's alive. It's pulsing. It's moving. It thrills with something beyond itself. That dead man on the slab that I discovered as a kid, that's your soul on sin. It starts to disintegrate, begin to come apart, fester and fall. So when Jesus calls Lazarus back to life, he's not healing a body. He's restoring a soul. He's not commanding flesh to be healed. He's commanding the shade of Lazarus, gone down into Hades, to come into the light. And there are consequences for Mary and for Martha and for the others that are gathered there to witness it. He gives them a command. Unbind him. Let him go. There is not one of us in here today who is not now or has not been in the past dead. Dead because of sin. Dead because we find ourselves in a dead-end job or dead-end relationship. Dead because our life hasn't turned out the way we want it. Trapped, bound up, tied up in nooses of our own making. There's not one of us that hasn't at least peeked around the corner at death, even if then we turned and ran the other direction. And what Jesus says to us today is name, your name, calling you by name, come out. Come forth. Step into the light. And what he says to the rest of us, those of us gathered around, those being restored to life, unbind them. Let them go. We hear confessions here every day. That's not because I'm trying to cultivate scrupulous consciences in people. It's quite the opposite. It's because I know from my own experience and from my experience of you all, you suffer. You suffer in your sins. Everyone who goes into that box goes in dead, and everyone who comes out alive. That is the tomb of Lazarus right there. And I might not be able to say, get up to the corpse. But I can say to those struggling with sin, live. Live. Live the way you were always meant to. Face death head on so that you can live the way you were always meant to. Unbind them. Let them go. So in these last days of Lent, as we draw near the mysteries of the Lord's own passion and death, as we come to face the possibility of life itself dying, of heaven descending to hell, don't be afraid. Don't let this year pass you by. Make this the time you face that darkest, deepest part of your soul, the stuff you don't even want to admit yourself, let alone your spouse or your kids or your folks. Bring to the confessional, bring to the altar, bring before God's face everything in you that needs restored to life. Let the pale shade of your soul be brought into the light, and let the parts of you that are dead teem again, pulse with vitality. And be ready, friends, that when the one next to you is likewise called to life, you might help unbind them and let them go.